is 2014. And it seems as though on a weekly, if not daily basis, new technology happens, right? Information communications technology, which is leading some to question how these technologies will impact society. Today, to discuss that with us, we have Hugh F. Klein, who is an adjunct professor of education and sociology at Teachers College, Columbia University. I am your host, Jasmine McNeely. Welcome to New Books in Technology.
The book is Information Communication Technology and Social Transformation, a Social and Historical Perspective. I want to get some background on you, though, because this is what we always do with our guests on the show. So perhaps you could just tell us about yourself. How did you get to this point, where you are right now, and up to writing the book?
Okay. Well, I'm a sociologist by training. I received my PhD in sociology in a department which was a combination of various social science disciplines. So if you gave me the who am I test, I probably would answer social scientist with a concentration in sociology. I got my degree back in the mid-70s from the Department of Social Relations at Harvard University. My work at Harvard was preceded by 2 years of where I began my graduate work at Stockholm University in Sweden. And it was actually there that I began to develop my interest in technology. I had an opportunity to work with a professor there who was a mathematical sociologist, and he was doing research on intergenerational social mobility. The Swedes have enormous records, which they keep in the Swedish National Church, the Lutheran Church, so that you can go back into almost the Middle Ages and trace families with their church records. And so it became a matrix manipulation project for this professor, and I got a chance to work with him. And we worked with one of the very earliest forms of a digital computer in Sweden. It had 8K storage, and I got my introduction there. And since then, I've just continued my interest in technology and the ways in which it's being used and the ways in which it is bringing about various kinds of changes in society. After I left Harvard, I taught for 2 years at the University of California campus in Santa Barbara. I then was invited to become a visiting scholar at Russell Sage Foundation in New York City. Russell Sage is a foundation that supports research with the mandate to attempt to improve social living conditions in the United States. And I wound up spending 10 years at Russell Sage Foundation, and then ultimately serving as president of the foundation. And when I left that, my children were in school in Princeton, New Jersey, where I was living and commuting to New York City. And so I decided to stay in the area, and I went to work with Education Testing Service. And there again, I had an opportunity to pursue my interest in the ways in which technology was being used, and more focus there on educational institutions. When I reached age 62, I retired from ETS and became an adjunct professor of sociology and education at Teachers College at Columbia. All during these years, I was involved in various kinds of projects looking at the ways in which technology was being used in a variety of different institutions. And I began accumulating a perspective and notes, knowing that someday I wanted to put all this down and author a book on my own. I'll have several other books that I've done with other colleagues, mostly research project reports. This one I wanted to do on my own. And I spent a lot of time working on it. It's over 14 years. I was using portions of my material for teaching at the Teachers College, but I kept working on the idea that I wanted to take a look at the ways in which information and communication technologies, computers and networks, were changing many aspects of our society. And during that time, I became more appreciative of an historical perspective, because as I thought more about ways in which computers were being used, it seemed to me that there were lessons to be learned by looking historically at some of these social institutions. The book is a report, a summary of my observations, and the main theme or the leitmotif of the book is that the many changes that we see and that are occurring with increasing frequency in our society that are attributable to the use of technologies, information and communication technologies, are really not new in the sense that they are innovations that have not occurred in history. Rather, most of the things that we see are a continuation of changes that have their roots back in our ancient past. And I'll give you a quick example. We are all aware of the fact that we communicate differently with one another using computer networks and mobile technologies. And that we are communicating in many new ways that we have not, that were not available in the past. But if we go back to the history of human communication and begin looking at the major innovations that have occurred over the past several thousand years, we go back to ancient Greece, when people first started writing and reading. There was a great deal of consternation, and it's apparently well documented that people like Plato and Aristotle voiced strong objections to having people learn to read and write. And their objections were in part based on the concern that if people wrote things down, that the human capacity for memory would diminish. That there wouldn't be anyone around who could recite the great epic poems of Homer from memory, because you could write them down and people could read them. And there was a concern that this would result in a degradation of human intellectual capacities. And indeed, it is true. There are very few people who can recite the Iliad and the Odyssey this day. However, what reading and writing did do is it really gave us the basis for civilization, because we could send information over distances. Previously, we were restricted to people within the range of the human voice. And more importantly, we could write things down and transmit them to future generations so that we could begin to accumulate knowledge. If we look a little further forward in history, there was a great consternation and concern when the printing press started being used widely. Now we're jumping ahead to the 14th, 15th century, and people were concerned, particularly the people who were involved in the production of religious manuscripts, were concerned that printing, if an error were made in the printing of, let's say, the New Testament, and you printed 1,000 copies with an error in it, that was 1,000. And that was concern. Now, it is interesting that the people who voiced those concerns, many of them were the monks who were involved, been involved for many generations in copying the manuscripts. And they also complained that the elaborate illustrations that frequently went with the copied manuscripts would instill a certain amount of piety in the people who were reading it. And at least in the early days of printing, you couldn't reproduce those kinds of drawings, and all you got was the printed text. Well, that same theme of objections to innovations in patterns and modes of communication, we can see people who were involved in telegraph were concerned that telephones would put them out of business. Well, indeed, there are very few telegraph systems that operate these days. In fact, in India. It was announced just last year that the telegraph system there was operated by the Indian government, and they sent their last telegraph message sometime last summer. And so, indeed, the telegraph industry. And the same thing happened when television came along. People in the film industry were worried that television would ruin the film industry. In each of these instances where there's been a resistance and concerns, each time we innovated and expanded our modes of communicating with one another. And now there are people who are writing things saying that the internet is making us stupid and that the children can't read and write any longer. Well, it's true. I know teaching in a graduate school, teaching younger people, they write differently than we do. In my book, I tell a quick story of a couple of years ago, a student who had taken my course, and I encouraged the students to engage in the online discussions in between meetings of the course. And as the semester wore on, more and more of the students were using the kind of grammar and style and punctuation or lack thereof that you find in text messaging. And you know, for those online discussions, that didn't bother me. But one of the students then, at the end of the semester, asked me to serve on her doctoral dissertation committee. As an adjunct, I can't do that. I can serve on a committee. So I agreed. And I said, but I want you to send me each chapter as you finish them. I don't want to wait until the end and read the whole thing. So she started sending me chapters, and they were, you know, the kinds of things with lack of punctuation and improper spelling and all shorthand uses of things. And so I wrote back to her and said, you know, the content is good, but this is not appropriate scholarly writing. And you've got to put it in the format that's appropriate for, a scholarly journal. So she took my advice, but she didn't really change very much. And so when the final dissertation came in, I started reading it, and I got very irritated because I'd spent a lot of time telling her where I think she was not communicating properly. And so I was prepared to go to the dissertation in a teacher's college. It's a public event, but I was prepared to go and not vote in favor of approving the dissertation until it was put in the proper format. But the night before I sat down, I said, well, I'm going to reread this whole thing so I'm prepared to point to places. Well, as I read along, I had to admit to myself that, you know, it's not the spelling is bad, mix of things like there and there, or weather and weather, and the cases were wrong frequently in pronouns. Punctuation was non-existent. But I could understand what she was saying. And it made me stop and think, you know, the purpose of grammar and proper spelling is to communicate clearly. And she was communicating clearly. So I gave a little speech at the dissertation hearing the next day saying, you know, this is not scholarly writing, but it is clear. And I was prepared to vote no, but having reread it, I will now vote in favor of passing it. And I made the comment to the other members of the committee that, you know, 15 years from now, she may be the editor of one of our leading journals. And the editors will be have a different style and way of communicating. So I tell that little story in the book because I think it emphasizes the point that communication is not a static thing, and that when changes occur, there are many people who get upset and concerned. But one of the things I hope to do in this book is to convince readers to step back a moment and not be concerned about such things and look at this in a longer historical framework. And I think it's easier to understand and appreciate. And then when other innovations come along, and I think I see some evidence that there may be a resurgence of iconography. That is, the use of pictures to tell stories that might supplement text. Some of the ways in which we interact with some of the computer systems now, instead of as we did in the early days of computing, we'd type in an instruction that would say print and then indicate the file that should be printed. Now, when you reach over to a screen and touch a little icon of a print, of a printer, and that's how we activate it. So it's quite possible, I don't know for certain, but it's quite possible that we may further extend our capacity for communication by combining multimodal communication, which would include text and pictures and perhaps increasing the audio and video. So that's sort of the leitmotif, and what I do is I look at across the major social institutions. The chapters are organized that way so that we look at such things as socialization and education, economy, political processes, and look at the innovations that are occurring there and relate them back to trends of historical change that have occurred in each of those major innovations.
What do you see as the importance of doing interdisciplinary study of things like technology and ICTs in particular? I see that a lot more interdisciplinary, and I think it's a good thing. Just from your perspective.
Yeah. Well, I, having been trained, did my graduate work in a at least interdisciplinary social science department. I think the future of advances in science and in applications in fields like engineering will clearly come from interdisciplinary work. I think it's a trend that has been going on for some time and will continue, I'm quite certain. If you look at what's happening on a number of major university campuses, you'll find that interdisciplinary programs are increasing, and in fact, buildings are being constructed to allow this kind of interdisciplinary here at where I live in beside Princeton University. Same thing is true at Columbia. There are facilities that are being constructed so that engineers and neurologists and computer scientists and psychologists can work together on projects. And so they occupy the same space. I think we'll see more and more of that. I take it as a sign of maturation in the sciences that we are seeing more and more interdisciplinary work. The work that's going on in the area of brain scanning is just fascinating and opens up all sorts of things. And yet the people who are working in that area, they need collaboration among engineers and psychologists and neurologists in order to make those advances. I think genetics is the same kind of thing, advances that we're seeing there. So all of those are examples of technology, and I think technology facilitating that kind of interdisciplinary collaboration.
Great. Now, one of the answers you gave just a few seconds ago dealt with history. The many changes that are attributed to technology now have roots in history. And I reminded, when you said that, it reminded me of Roz Williams' chapter from Manuel Castells' book.
Yep.
And she says one of her refrains is history matters. And I was just wondering, perhaps if you could discuss perhaps our societal either lack of understanding of history, lack of recognition of the historical foundations of a lot of our technologies.
Yes, well, I think that's a fascinating question. I think all too often we deal with problems in contemporary societies that they're new, and we do not recognize that society evolves, sometimes quickly and sometimes slowly, but clearly in evolution. So I am one who believes that historical perspectives would be well introduced and used by people in almost every discipline. I'm currently working my way through a book called Technology and World History, by someone by the name of Daniel Hedrick. And he starts with the Stone Age and works his way up to contemporary times. And there are a number of interesting themes that he pursues and continues working on. So I think we don't pay enough attention to the history of technology either. And I think that there's a growing appreciation of that need and the utility, fruitfulness and utility.
Absolutely. Now, you described the book as discussing, examining, and analyzing the ways in which ICTs are changing many things, many aspects of society. And one of the terms you use in the book is e-social change. I was wondering if perhaps you could discuss what you mean by that phrase, e-social change.
When I finished writing this book, I gave it the title, e-social change. Because what I wanted to do was stress that so much of the social change that we are experiencing today can be related to the fact that we're operating in an E or an I environment. And I think I say that early on in the book. I don't think it's awkward to say that when Routledge invited me to publish the book with them, I sent them the manuscript with that title, and they wrote back and said, no, that's not appropriate for the series that we do. Academic is a first-rate, Routledge is a first-rate academic publisher, and I think it made them a little nervous to have that title. So they came up with the title of Information Communication Technology and Social Transformation, a Social and Historical Perspective. And I was happy to have Routledge publish the book, so I was not going to turn down their offer. But I find that is an awkward title, and I would suspect a lot of people would have difficulty in if you walk by this in a bookstore, how many people would stop and say, what's that about, and pick it up and look at it? Whereas e-social change might have had a different... I'm using my book as a textbook in my course, and I'm hoping that people who are teaching courses in the social sciences, particularly introductory courses at the college or graduate level, would find a book of this sort useful supplementary reading, that it would develop an awareness on the part of students of the utility of an historical perspective, and I would hope that it would be adopted that way. I also hope that the book will get a general readership of people who get exposed to the articles about the, you know, the internet's making us stupid, or students don't know how to communicate, and just put those observations in a broader context. So I was hoping that it would be, but I would have been very comfortable with the e-social change.
Great. Now, in the book, you say patterns and trends, or you examine patterns and trends and how the uses of ICT are affecting changes in our major societal institutions. This language reminds me a little bit of, medium is the message, kind of. And I'm going to ask you a question, and I hope it's not a loaded question, although I think it is, kind of. And
go ahead.
That is, do you consider yourself a technological determinist?
No, I do not consider myself a technological determinist. If I had to put a label on my thinking, I might put something like an explorer of how technology is modifying patterns of social change. And I would say, and I think that's an ongoing activity. I might just mention that in the course of writing this book, every day I scan some of the regular media, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, I regularly read the major journals in sociology, social history. There's a special organization and journal, the Chronicle of Higher Education. And I made notes every time I've read about something, an innovation, an adaptation that involved using technology across the board, in education, in the economy, in the political, in the polity, the political realm of our society. And I would make notes, and as I was writing the book, I kept scanning these things and saying, you know, one of the reasons I took so long to write the book was I keep adding more and more things, and there's no way to write a book that would be current. And so, excuse me, I've opened a web page of my own. I have not had one previously. And once the book is out a few more months, and hopefully more and more people will see it, I intend to do a monthly update to my webpage in which I will cite things that are happened recently that substantiate some of the general points that I make in the book. So there are new ways in which computers are being used in remedial education at the elementary level, and I will want to put those all up on the website. So that if a professor is using my book as a supplementary text, he can tell his students, well, you go to hughklein.com and you'll see the updates that are relevant for Chapter 4 or Chapter 5 or Chapter 6 on the economy, mm-hmm. education, and the polity. So I hope to make it, to keep it more current by supplementing the printed book distribution with what would be available as regular updates on the internet, that people can go and see that these things, current things, are still relevant for the general points in the book.
Mm-hmm. So, one of the points of analysis in your book deals with what you call the normative order.
Yes.
And about the value, shared values that we have societally. And I was wondering, taking into account recent events, and events that I guess have been continuing for a long time with respect to the internet and online communities and those different things, do you think that shared values or the normative order is fracturing a bit?
Well, it's a very good question, and it's one that we could have raised in the 1920s or in the 1880s, at least in North America. And the extent to which the patterns of communication that people are involved in using online facilities, using the social networks, whether that is taking us forward and producing more unity and more uniformity, greater shared values, or whether it is taking us in the opposite direction and fostering disunity, disagreement, and tensions, I think is by no means clear. For example, if we look at some recent events that we know have been facilitated by the use of the internet, things like the Arab Spring, Occupy Wall Street, the climate march, climate change march, all of these things have been greatly facilitated by the fact that you can send an email out to literally millions of people, encouraging them to participate in these kinds of activities. That's different. You weren't able to rally that kind of people in the 1880s or in the 1920s, rally those numbers of people for participation in what is, writ large, the political processes of society. Whether that's going to splinter us or not, I don't know. In my teaching, I encourage students to think in terms of, all right, let's break that down into some researchable questions and see what we can learn. Let's do some research and find out something about the patterns and content of ICT-facilitated communications. And I suspect that we'll find a mixed pattern, but I think it could be informative to do that kind of research.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're just talking about global issues and the climate march and those things. And related to ICT, though, I was wondering, particularly about the phrase information communication technology. It's used a lot, say, with Africa, Asia, Europe, but ICT is really not a phrase or word that's used a lot in the States. And I was wondering, why do you think that is?
That's an interesting question. I don't know. Let me make sure I understand. You're saying that the phrase information technology is not widely used in, say, North America?
Well, information communication technology, that phrase or that phrasing, ICT, there's very few usages. Obviously, it means, it has meaning, but ICT as a name of a certain kind of discipline or integration of various disciplines, integration of various technologies, it's not really used a lot in the States, particularly, not necessarily North America, but the States.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, that's interesting. My sense is that, and maybe because I use it, I'm more sensitive to it, that I see it used more frequently now than I did, say, 5 years ago, or 10 years ago. That I think people are recognizing that I'll put it this way, that social networking is changing the way people, the way our economy operates. And people writing that the new forms of consumerism, both advertising and purchasing, are facilitated by ICTs. I see that that phrase being used increasingly. Or in the field of education, I see more and more people using this phrase, referring to modes of teaching and learning that are enabled with the use of computers and networks.
Right. Yeah. ICT for D, ICT for E, development, education, and a lot of different other aspects. I was wondering, in your book, you promise not to make any predictions about the future, and you do that until the very end, right? But yeah. So I was wondering, where do you think, if you can, you know, since this is not the book and you can speak freely, where do you think ICTs are going in the very near future?
Well, that's also an interesting question. I think generally, because we are able to reduce the size and expense of connecting into networks down to the point where we have handheld devices, that we're going to see these devices distributed more frequently in developing nations than we've seen so far. There are reports that that the use of cell phones in sub-Saharan Africa is becoming very widespread, mm-hmm. because they are cheap to buy and they're relatively cheap to make connections to networks. And so the use of ICTs is spreading more rapidly in developing nations in Africa, India. China already has more people using the internet regularly than we do in this country, than the total population of this country. And it spreads very quickly because of the reduced cost and utility of the mobile devices. So I see mobility as being a huge influence in developing nations. And in some respects, it's hard to predict what the consequences will be. I think we can see it from their growing economies, but what the consequences will be for political organization, for government agencies, for the delivery of government services, those are all areas that I see will be important in the future. And all of that, I think, will facilitate globalization. Potentially, can result in greater forms of cooperation among nations, which that would be an enormous positive benefit if that could occur. If it's managed properly, there is that potential, and I think that's very, very exciting if that can be brought to bear.
Absolutely. Now, you just answered the question about what you think the future of ICTs are. What's next for you?
That's a good question. I found myself getting involved in the problems of education, particularly at the elementary level, just through a network which is not technology based. Some people asked me to come in and help them look at some information about the potential use of a computer program to get to elementary school kids, inner city elementary school kids, and get them to read on grade level by the time they enter middle school. In a nearby town here where I am in Trenton, New Jersey, it's estimated that 75% of the kids who enter fourth grade are not reading on grade level. And that's a disaster, because if you can't read by the time you get to middle school, you're very unlikely to graduate from high school, and then your lifestyle is very much influenced by that. One of the things that I think is underappreciated with respect to information technology is the fact that you can give feedback on something instantly. So if you have a computer program that's teaching children reading skills, and you teach them about silent E, for example, and then you have a little game that they play which will demonstrate whether or not they understand the way silent E works at the end of a word. And if they get it, then you move on to a more complex topic in reading skills. And if they don't, then you have remediation immediately, instantly. And it's the functional equivalent of having every student having an individual teacher, tutor, mm-hmm. each student having a tutor. And we've been able to demonstrate in a project that we're running here that if you do this with intensity, that is, not just let kids sit in front of a computer program a couple minutes a day, but an hour a day, every day, you can bring about enormous gains in reading skills. Here's an opportunity to use that immediate feedback that you can get from a computer system, potentially to great advantage. So I've gotten intrigued with that, and I found myself involved in it. It's not a piece of scholarly work. It might result in a couple of research reports, but it also might result in a lot of kids having a lot more opportunities later in their life. So I've gotten interested in that. At least in the near future, I am intrigued by continuing to read all of the media and the scholarly journals that I do, and building up my list of things. Maybe someday there'll be a second edition with updated examples. But that's I'm not certain about that. But putting it together and getting it ready to go up online, which I'll be doing shortly. That is that, and helping little kids learn to read. Those two things are occupying my activities and interests right now.
What will be the URL for the website? Do you know?
Yes, it's very simple. It's HughKlein.com. Even I can, in my old age, can remember that.
Great. So the book is Information Communication Technology and Social Transformation, A Social and Historical Perspective. We've had Hugh Klein on New Books in Technology. We thank you, Hugh, for coming on the show.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been fun.
Absolutely. And that's New Books in Technology for this week. Have a great one.